Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? And welcome to this new session of the Intellectual Seerah. We're going to be talking about Khaybar, one of the key events, actually very topical and political event because it's been used in some of the protests, in the pro-Palestine protests, actually been referred to as anti-Semitic, interestingly enough, by the British police, interestingly. The Metropolitan Police considered the sloganeering of Khaybar, some of the guys, as an anti-Semitic slogan. So it's topical from that perspective. Obviously, it's another, you could say, the final chapter of the relationship between the Jews, if you like, or a subsection of the Jewish society and Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and the Muslim people in general. And we'll be doing as we do usually, employing the interdisciplinary approach to try and understand some of the issues at hand. And we'll be talking about some psychology, a little bit of history, and opening up the floor for some questions and answers, discussions and facilitation of all of that. So, actually, before I begin with that, there's if you see the slides, there's a few incidents and issues which don't fit neatly into any of the particular topics. So, for example, we spoke about Ahzab, we spoke about Uhud, we spoke about... But there are some issues in the Seerah which I came across, a lot of the Seerah people of the English-speaking type, speaking about and using it as a kind of istidlal, as a kind of evidence-making. And I thought it would be interesting to mention them. One of them is the incident of the praying of some Christians in the mosque. Okay, so there is a riwayah, there is a hadith, which says that there were some Christians that came and that they were allowed to pray in the mosque of the Prophet. And I've seen many of the contemporary Seerah people embellish this and say, well, this shows that Islam is a very tolerant religion and this wouldn't be allowed today, and if someone tried to do it today, then they would be shunned and so on. But then I did a bit of research myself on this incident and found that, unfortunately, there is no sahih hadith of such an incident taking place. In fact, Ibn al-Qayyim here mentions, and I've copied and pasted exactly what he says. He says, وَلَمْ نَقِفْ لِهَذِهِ الْقِصَّةِ عَلَى إِسْنَادٍ غَيْرِ إِسْنَادٍ مِنْ إِسْحَاقِ السَّابِقِ وَهُوَ مُعْضَلْ, and so on and so forth. He says he only found such and such isnad of this particular person, and it's not effectively a strong hadith. So to try and build a jurisprudential case that, okay, it's okay for polytheistic practices to be effectively, because you're saying Christians and Jews or maybe polytheists or Hindus can come and pray their own prayer in the mosque, then you're effectively saying that, you know, polytheism can be done in the mosque. What a big claim to be making, and using the seerah and the weak seerah to try and make that claim is very unsubstantiated, very unusual that some prolific and scholarly type or academic type people would make this case. But it seems to be part and parcel of the apologetic approach, the capitulationist approach, the accommodationist approach that many of the people would use in order to try and say Islam is a very tolerant religion and that we've got it all wrong. And this is one side of the extreme. And there's a very, very clear verse in the Quran, Surah Al-Jinn, إِنَّ الْمَسَاجِدَ لِلَّهِ فَلَا تَدَعُ مَعَ اللَّهِ أَحَدًا, that masajid are for Allah, so do not call any other than Allah in the masjids. So, I mean, to bring a weak hadith to try and make a case that, okay, some Christians can pray in the masjid and do their own ritualistic, polytheistic practices, I think this is more indicative of cultural decay and weakening of the Muslim community in the Western world, the accommodationist approach, than anything else. But having said this, we go, and once again, these are some things that are not necessarily mentioned in any of the topics, but I just thought I'd mention this. Another interesting thing is the story of Thumama. Now, we don't have the opportunity here, because it would de-scope what we're trying to do, to discuss the story of Thumama, but I think at some point we should mention the story of Thumama. There was also a very interesting discussion of the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Zainab bint Muhammad, and Abu al-As, okay, who was her husband, and obviously he was a husband who was not Muslim. And at one point she gave him aman. Aman is the idea of giving security to someone who is not Muslim, which is a very interesting concept. But it shows a lot, actually, because in that particular context, you have a woman here, okay, which is the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, giving security and aman to, aman is this idea of security, and therefore you have the idea from it which comes, which is al-mustamin. You have three categories of disbelievers, or three categories of ways in which you would deal with disbelievers in a Muslim state. One of them is the dhimmi, and the Muwahhid, or Muwahhid, and then the Mustatmin, or Mustatmin. I've heard them saying be pronounced in both ways, Mustatmin, Mustatmin. I don't know which one is there. Maybe both are correct, I don't know. Mustatmin or Mustatmin.
Should be Mustatmin.
Maybe Mustatmin. Given, yeah, it could be. Anyway, these are three categories. One of them, Dhimmi, is a person who has to pay the tax, which we maybe we'll talk about one day, the jizya tax, and it's very, they say it's a discriminatory tax. I don't know why it's such a discriminatory tax. It's just a tax that people will have to pay. It's not zakat because it doesn't purify the wealth. We don't consider anything unless it's done for Allah's sake to be purifying, because the word zakat come from the idea of purification. It doesn't purify anyone's wealth, but it's a kind of tax that they is levied in exchange for protection. But on the point, you have the dhimmi who pays this tax and then is given security by the Muslims. And then you have the mu'ahid, or the mu'ahad, you see, the person who does that, or some kind of a treaty between, which you mentioned already. And then you have the mustatmin, or the mustatman, or this idea that this person has been given a man, or a security. I mean, you'll find in many of the tribal cultures, especially in Pashto cultures, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you guys are much more learned and aware of this than me. But one of the issues of Osama bin Laden and why he was given security is because when these Pashtus give their word of security, it's not going to happen. No one's going to go against that. It will be seen as completely dishonorable. And so countries can go to war on the basis, basically, that, you know, this person's given security by these other people. And so the tribal code, and this continues until this day, of giving security, the idea of giving security to someone, is a very important thing. And we'll be speaking about this maybe in this context as well. But it's interesting that Zainab bint Muhammad, who was the daughter of the Prophet ﷺ, who was married at the time, because the nikah had been done before Islam, before the rulings had come down, to a disbeliever. She gave this man protection, and so no one could harm him. You see, this is a very interesting thing, and they got the idea from that. And we also have some other fiqhi rulings of some contemporaries that some say, I mean, this is very shared and aberrational opinion, that if someone gets into Islam, and let's say, for example, a Christian woman and a Muslim man are married. A Christian woman and a Christian man are married. Yeah. And then the woman becomes Muslim. So this splinter group of scholars, some of the contemporary scholars have said, this shows you that it's still possible for the nikah to be continued, even if the man is Christian. So they have this very, I would call it very aberrational view. But they use this, you should be aware, they use this story of Zainab bint Muhammad and Abul As as a way to justify this. But even those people, they don't say that you can do it ibtida'an, which you can. They would never say that a Muslim woman can marry a Christian man from the beginning and the nikah would not be valid. But they're talking about a very specialized context and they use this story. But it seems to me that this is a very mardood and rejected opinion, and it's extremely isolated. I mean, but you should know the story about that. But to give this as a kind of jurisprudential reasoning is something you should be aware of. This isn't a fiqh class, and I'm certainly not going to go into details about that. But I'm just making you aware of certain things, because I think it's still important for you to be aware of certain things. But if this was an acceptable opinion, then it would have been shared among many different people across the centuries of 1,400 years. It wouldn't be something which only a few people here and there would be talking about. So these are just very important. The story of Thumam is important because it shows you a man who became Muslim due to the behaviors of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Like, he just observed the Prophet Muhammad and he saw, because of his khuluq, his virtues and his behavior, his generosity, his forbearance, his magnanimity, all of these things, that positive things that we've spoken about before, he observed that and then he became Muslim on his own volition due to observing that. But once again, that's something we may cover at some other time. These are some important things in Seerah. On the point, today we're going to be speaking about Khaybar, and there's a difference of opinion among the scholars of when this took place. Is it the 6? Is it 6 AH or is it 7 AH? So maybe it's one or the other. I don't know, to be honest with you. Some say this and some say that, but either way, it's either 6 or 7. And of course, Khaybar is a place in present-day Saudi Arabia, and it's a big place in terms of geographic landmass kind of proximity. It's got big landmass. It's probably even bigger than Al Medina, really, if you think about it. If you think about the proximity, not now, because now Medina has been expanded, it's become a massive city, if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. But at the time of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, it was probably going to be bigger. And it, you know, it was inhabited by these Jewish tribes. Some even Banu Nadir and Banu Qaynuqa went there and spent some time there as well. It was a place which had a lot of date palm trees, and therefore had a lot of produce, and therefore had a lot of money being generated. Okay, and you should be aware also that these people of Khaybar, the Jews of Khaybar, did not have a peace treaty with the Muslims. It's very important. You know, when the Medinan constitution took place, it included Banu Nadir, Banu Qaynuqa, and Banu Qurayza, I believe, but it did not include these people at all in Khaybar. The Jews in Khaybar, they did, in fact, they were complicit and co-collaborators in the Ahzab war, which we spoke about. So they were assisting. Obviously, they have a Jewish connection, and they wanted to assist the Jews of Banu Qurayza. They wanted to help them, and so on and so forth. And so they were complicit. As a result of this hostile behavior that we have now witnessed, and that the proximity between Medina and Khaybar, I don't know, maybe 90 kilometers, maybe 100 kilometers, something like that, which means on a horse, maybe about 3 hours or something to get there, maybe 4 hours. It's not that far away, actually. 2-3 hours, I don't know, you know, something like this. Maybe 3-4 hours. Or a camel, maybe two, I don't know how it works, but you can see. And by car, maybe it'll take an hour, you know, something like that. But the point is that the decision was taken that there would be a strike, a retaliatory strike, on the people of Khaybar. Okay, there would be a strike. Now, the way Khaybar was constructed was, it wasn't just like this one united front, and that you have the, you know, the army and so on. And no, it was mini fortresses. So you had one fortress, second fortress, third fortress, and all these people were protected within their own fortress. And you may have like dozens of people in each fortress. So the war took place. It was actually a series of war. Now, the very interesting is, in Surah Al-Fath, which we already covered, Allah mentions, وَمَغَانِمَ كَثِيرَةً تَأْخُذُونَهَا فَعَجَّلَ لَكُمْ هَذِهِ, that you will be given a lot of provisions. You'll be given a lot of produce, little provisions and so on. And Allah will make this quick for you. He'll expedite that for you. And the majority opinion among the Mufassirs, the exegetes on this ayah, is that it's not talking about Fathu Makkah, which we're going to discuss in the lesson after next. But it's talking, in fact, about Khaybar itself. That when Surah Al-Fath is saying that there will be a great victory which will give you this, a lot of produce and so on, is talking about this thing that happened. Now, let's get controversial a little bit, maybe, because we've spoken about some of the basic facts. Let's explain, because someone is going to be thinking, okay, this is the third time, or in fact, maybe even the fourth time, where you've spoken about Banu Nadir, and you've spoken about Banu Qurayza, and you've spoken about Banu Qaynuqa, and now you're speaking about the Jews of Khaybar. There are four clashes in the Seerah between Muslims and Jews that we can see, that we can identify. Now, we now have to start putting our interpretation hats on and start being honest with ourselves and saying, why is this happening? There needs to be some kind of explanation mechanism. Because someone will say, look, Islam is a hostile religion, clearly. It's attacking the Jews at every opportunity it finds. Look at this. It cannot be a coincidence. But let's look at it from another perspective. It's very interesting. There is a concept referred to as the narcissism of small difference. Others refer to it as the narcissism of minor difference. Okay. And this is a psychoanalytic precept. And the idea is, when you have a people that are more close to each other, but there are some differences, there's more likely to be clash. So if you find, for example, in early Christianity, you'll find that, you know, the Arian controversy or something, or Catholics and Protestants. I mean, Catholics and Protestants, if you know anything about European history, they had some of the most bloody wars against each other, more so than wars with other people. Shiites and Sunnis. I mean, not as much as the Catholics and Protestants. Actually, no comparison whatsoever. But compared, I mean, there are, we wouldn't consider them to be big difference compared to the atheists, for example, or Christians. There's more similarities that we have than, do you know what I mean? And the same thing could be said with Judaism and Islam. Of all the religions on the face of the earth, isn't it interesting that the two probably most closely related religions are Judaism and Islam? Yet, you'll find most problems between these two groups. Now, why is that the case? It's because, I mean, if you are looking at it from a psychoanalytic perspective, when you have people of a similar belief system, but there are some clear differences, psychologists like Freud, by the way, and I've gotten something here for you to read, would refer to this as the narcissism of small differences. The differences are seen as big, even though they may be small compared to other things. Other, for example, comparisons. Like, compare Islam and Judaism on the one hand, and Islam and polytheism. Which one has bigger chasms and greater disparities? Obviously, the latter. So, that can be a way of, for example, if you're a Jewish clergy or political leaders or even cultural leaders, and you're seeing this new religion, you consider it to be a new religion, which is speaking about Moses, is speaking about Abraham, is speaking about Noah, is speaking about all the things that you know. It's even referring to them specifically. You know, there's no other religion that speaks about Jews as much as Islam and refers to Jews in as much in the same way as Islam in the primary text. Not even Christianity does, which is interesting because it's a continuation. You see, so the point is what I'm trying to say is then you're seeing this other religion now is acting as a competitor. And just like somebody is more likely to be jealous of their own, let's call it brother. Sisters are more likely to be jealous of each other. Co-wives are more likely to be jealous of each other. Brothers, Yusuf and the brothers, for example, could be. People of the same race are more likely to be jealous and angry with each other. Cousins. Why? Because it's like there's direct lines of comparison. So you're competing with me on my ground. You're competing with me for example, the love of my mother and father. You're competing with me from the validation of the community. You'll see certain people, black on black crime, for example. Why? What's this going on? It's because you're in the same category. You can feel jealous that this guy, oh, the Arabs are killing each other. Why? Maybe it's because they were Kuwait and Iraq. I don't know. Or it has to be, it's us. It could be anything. But sometimes when you're in the same category, like dentists, if you're a dentist, okay, you're more likely to be jealous of another dentist. If you're a doctor, you're more likely to be jealous. If you're an alim, Islamic alim, you're more likely to be jealous and resentful and competitive with. But if you're now competing for religious market share, then you're more likely to be jealous and resentful of people who are competing with new market share. So it's you can employ psychoanalytic approaches to the behaviors of some of the Jewish tribes and reactions to Islam. And you could use this idea of the narcissism of small difference as an idea as to why were they so hostile? Why were they continually collaborating? We wouldn't say, and this is where it does, someone could say, well, you're trying to be anti-Semitic again. Say, we're not saying this because of their biology. We're not saying any of that. We're just saying this is a natural way that anybody from any background will respond. And this is in fact backed by some kind of psychology. So that's one way of doing it. To get even more controversial, one could say another way of doing it is because of Jewish supremacy theology. And we've already spoken about this. And just to remind you of this, is we've mentioned this man, Rabbi Schneerson. And just to remind you of what he said, all creation, including the heavens and the earth, are vanity compared to the Jews. And you've got Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. He says, the purpose of the Goy, which is the Gentiles, the purpose of the Goy is to serve the Jews. He asks a question. He says, why are the non-Jews created? Because this is it's bewildering him. He doesn't understand, the rabbi, why non-Jews were created. Why the black man was created. Why the Chinese man was created. The Arab man. The Persian man. The Kurdish man. The whatever man. The Turkish man. Why were these people even created? Because he was one day thinking, eating his kosher food and drinking his thing. And he was probably thinking to himself, why are these people even here? Let's be honest. This is what he's thinking. And this is one of the big, big rabbis. I'm not saying, okay, well, all rabbis are like this, all Jews, but this is what he said. Don't take it up with me. This is one of your big, big shots. And when you say, why were these guys created? It couldn't be because they wanted to, Allah wanted to test them and to see if they were going to do good deeds or bad deeds. It couldn't be the reason, purpose of life for these guys. It couldn't be because they, yani, to make the best of themselves and to see how much of the potential they could realize. It couldn't be for these reasons. But in fact, the reason why these were people were created is that they plow and they will reap. Yani, and we will sit like an effendi and we will eat. So I told you this guy was eating something. Say, oh, the food is here. Somebody must have made it for me. And it's for those guys to make it. For those servants to make my food, my sandwich. You're telling me that this idea was not present in the past? Yani, let's be honest with each other for a second, Yani. This is a strand of Jewish opinion. This is an interpretation of Judaism. This is Jewish theology supremacy. Now, let's be honest with you. We know that it's, I didn't bring to you the quotes of the Old Testament and the quotes from the Talmud. I could do that, and it will be an entire session on justice. I could bring all the quotes of this. I brought to you the quotes of the rabbis so that you can't say, well, you're misinterpreting it. It's not my interpretation. It's the interpretation of your top dogs. Your top dogs. Your big ones. This is their interpretation. They're saying this. So are you telling me in the past they didn't have this belief? Okay, let's think about it. You had the Enlightenment period. You had the Renaissance. You had the Enlightenment. You had all this. You have liberalism proliferating throughout the world. You have all of this. Did things, do you think now, are things diluted? Or are things not diluted? Do you think liberalism, now we know that the dominant world order is liberalism, would that dilute some of this propaganda or some of these talking points? Or would it not? I think it would dilute it. It's wrong for you to say this. Racism is seen as wrong now, after in the West and everywhere, most in the world. Most of parts of the world, racism is seen as wrong. So to say stuff like that, which is clearly racist, of course you're going to hide this. Which is why you'll find mostly the sources that these things are found them from are Hebrew sources, which I've translated for your convenience. Because what's said in Hebrew is not usually what's said in English. Because there's two kinds of discussions, two kinds of discourses. What you'll see in Hebrew is much more flagrant, much more wild. They can say what he wants. And they all laugh in the room. Not all the Jews do believe this, of course. But I'm saying the ones in the room who follow these rabbis, they'll laugh and say, yes, we agree, of course, you're a slave. You think I'm meant to be like this Arab? In present-day Israel is the most racist country in the world. Well, at least it's a contender for it. Present-day Israel. Do you think, here's a question. Does this kind of discourse from the top leading rabbis in the world today, does it feed into that racism or does it not feed into that racism? This is a question for the people. This is a question for the people. Do you think that if this is thing, are things people are saying now, and we have all these Talmudic quotes, which we've spoken about another time and we can speak about again, that that wouldn't feed into why someone would feel hostile towards other people? Of course. Look at the depiction, for example, of Ismail in the Old Testament. As a homework, in your own time, he's referred to as wild. I think he's a wild donkey even. Dehumanized. Why? Because he's the father of whom? The Arabs. You can't have a prophet that comes from another yani race. It has to be from our people. And this is what the Jewish supremacy theologians and proponents would say. This is why there was such hostility. In fact, we have primary source information. Safiya bint Huyay, and we'll cover this. Her ex-husband, when Safiya had the dream that the Prophet ﷺ, she had the dream the moon would come to her lap or something, and her husband, he interpreted that as there'll be a king of the Arabs who you're going to be with. He couldn't accept it, and he started attacking her physically because he understood, how could it be that it comes from these people? Prophethood cannot come outside of our confines. It has to be us. It has to be our tribe. Are you telling me that this which is clearly evidenced in the Talmud, in the Old Testament, in the words of the rabbis. Are you telling me we should forget about this because we're scared to be labeled anti-Semites? That this should not be a part and parcel of the analysis of why Khaybar and Banu Qinuqa and Banu Nadir and Banu Qurayza acted the ways they acted? Are you telling me we should completely disband that and not speak about that? If you are telling me that, I think that would be unfair. I think you're unfair to say this. I think we should reject such a thing. So when people ask, oh, well, why is the Prophet acting like this with these people? With these Jewish supremacy theologians? Zionism, if you're saying it's Zionism, then Zionism was in the 1800s, 1900s. I'm not saying it's only Zionism, I'm saying it's also Jewish supremacy theology, which predates Zionism by thousands of years. And Zionism incorporates parts of that, even though some Zionists might not even be religious. They may be secularists, they may be atheists, but for some reason they've still incorporated this idea that the special and the chosen, and everyone else is goy and Gentile and servant. And of course, if you think that, even the studies that are done on narcissism, one of the studies that I looked at was, and I read, don't ask me why, but I've read multiple books on narcissism. I've read multiple books on it. The studies say that when you're always told that you're right, that you don't have any corrective parents, your parents, think about this, studies show that if you don't have parents that tell you you're wrong from time to time, you're wrong, that you're always mollycoddling them, this and that, you're more likely to have what they call narcissistic traits. Now, I don't like, just as a caveat and as a tangent, I don't like the way modern people talk about narcissism. It's almost become, it's too subjective. And especially in the context of relationships, I think sometimes it's too loosely used. That is something we'll speak about in a different time. But this point I think still holds, which is that, imagine now, not only do you have a parent that's telling you you're always right, your God is telling you you're always right, no matter what you are, because of who you are, not because of your actions. It removes you of individual responsibility. Any action that removes you of individual responsibility is an action that it will grant you, or will entrench and embed within you, this idea of entitlement. And what is entitlement? Most definitions I've ever come across in psychology of the word entitlement is that where you believe that you deserve special treatment without cause or reason. And that is exactly Jewish theology supremacism. Jewish supremacy theology. That is it. That you are right on the basis not of what you do, but on the basis of who you are. Now some will object and say, well, that's not what we believe. We're Jews, we don't believe in this. I say, I'm not generalizing. I'm not saying all Jews believe in that. I'm not saying even all Jews believe in Judaism. We know that some Jews are atheists. They're ethnic Jews only. We know all of that. But I am saying that this must be considered. And this, of course, you're going to object. But I don't care about it. You can object, you can reject, you can interrogate, you can say, this is there. This is something we have to speak about here. We have to mention this. Anyway, we'll continue. Also, don't forget that there was, the Jewish tribes had a political placement in the Arabian world. And now you have a different, it was a political struggle as well. Even then, it was a political struggle. So the religious items and ideas were intertwined with the political ones. So that's another way of looking at it. This is images of Khaybar excavated. I wanted you to see what it would look like. Now, let's have a break and have a discussion. The question opened the thing is, what do you think the reason? Now we've covered all of the interactions between the Muslims and some of the Jewish tribes. In your opinion, and this is going to be easy, and I'll let you speak to the person next to you for 5 minutes. What do you think the reasons may be, considering all the factors we've mentioned, of some of these clashes between some of the Jews and some of the Muslims? We'll come back in 5 minutes. Okay, so let's have a feedback session. The question, just to remind everybody, was, we've seen all these clashes between some of the Jewish groups and the Muslims. of all the different explanations that we have spoken about, which one for you is most convincing and why? So let's start go ahead. Yes, Yahya, what do you think?
I would definitely say they had a lot in common, as you said. Mm. So they were both monotheistic faiths. Mm. But there was a difference where the Muslims were evangelizing people.
Mm.
And I think to some of them, they were scared that they would lose Jewish followers. So
I think that's an excellent point, actually.
Yeah, that's.
And they did lose some Jewish followers. They did. Does anyone know some of the names of some prominent Jewish people that became Muslim?
Rasulullah married.
Okay, so that's an excellent one. We're going to speak about Safiya bint Huyay, right?
Okay.
So she's definitely one of them. But who else?
Abdullah bin Salam.
Who? Abdullah bin Salam. Beautiful. Yeah, good example. Yeah. Who else?
The guy who converted and then died on the same day, this Khaybar. I don't know what was his name.
Was he Jewish?
Yeah. He converted. And
Died. Yes, he was Jewish, wasn't he? Yeah. Can you find his name? I forget.
Yeah.
Yes. Who else? In fact, I mean, it mentioned the Quran multiple times. Maybe two or three times. I cannot remember how many times, but it says, "قُلْ أَرَأَيْتُمْ إِنْ كَانَ مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ كَفَرْتُمْ بِهِ وَشَهِدَ شَاهِدٌ مِنْ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ عَلَى مِثْلِهِ فَآمَنَ وَاسْتَكْبَرْتُمْ." That this is a Quranic question. That say, "قُلْ أَرَأَيْتُمْ إِنْ كَانَ مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ." Imagine the Surah Al-Ahqaf, chapter 46. That say, imagine if this was from Allah and then you've disbelieved in it. وَشَهِدَ شَاهِدٌ مِنْ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ عَلَى مِثْلِهِ. And someone, one of the witnesses from Bani Israel, has said of his truth, this truth. And فَآمَنَ, he believed, وَاسْتَكْبَرْتُمْ, and you became haughty and arrogant about the situation. And in the same surah it says, they قَالُوا لَوْ كَانَ خَيْرًا مَا سَبَقُونَا إِلَيْهِ. It's a very interesting way of thinking about it. It shows, subhanAllah, the entitlement psychology of some of the Jewish supremacist ideologists and propagandists. The Quran is showing you this. That if it was good, there is no way these people would have known about it before we. Can you see what Allah is telling you here in the Quran? He's saying, if this is a good thing, there's no way these people would have come to it before you. Some of that entitlement thinking. So we are the ones who are the heads of civilization. We are the ones with the book. We are the ones with Moses. We are the ones with compendiums of Talmudic inscriptions and encyclopedias and so on and so forth. We are those. How could these people, backwards people, ever have something of that value and worth before us? If it was that good, do you think our community would not know of it before those people? This is in the Quran.
That's basically like for someone, like for example, if we would say a polytheist to become Muslim, there's actually a lot they would have to change slightly. Like they would have to take out all the statues out of their houses. They would need to do changes in their life.
Mm.
Whereas if a Jew becomes Muslims, there's very little they have to change.
Mm.
Other than maybe pray 5 times a day. You know, like they're just a small differences. But ideologically, there are very little differences. And so
that's a good thought experiment. If an Orthodox Jew became Muslim,
yeah,
he would have to learn how to recite the Quran and the Fatiha. He'd be praying 5 times a day rather than 3 in different times.
Yeah.
Okay, he's already used to this. He's already not eating pork. He's already not eating most of the things. He already understands some of the etiquettes. He already understands like gender relations and stuff and marriage and all. In fact, he's going to be more lenient now.
Yeah.
Because now the woman is going to find it easier to get a divorce. Yeah. Kosher food is much more meticulously prepared than halal food. The only difficulty is that they're not going to drink, because they're allowed to drink. I'm not sure if you know this, but you can have wine as a Jew. You're going to have more vivid understanding of the Day of Judgment. You have a stronger ideology now as a Muslim than you did as a Jew, of true belief in God. Before you had the belief of God that rests and all that. Now you don't have to have any of those beliefs. You're going to see the black man as equal to you. Maybe you didn't think that as a Jewish supremacist. If you were a Jew, maybe you did believe that. It depends on what you believed. maybe you'll become a little bit more outgoing. And maybe less. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Depends on what kind of temperament you have, or what kind of Jew you are. But in terms of, if you're an Orthodox Jew, right, you already know a lot about religion. And you already know there's a lot there that you're doing that you'd be doing as a conservative Muslim.
Yeah.
It's true.
There's the only thing they would also have to change is their view of Isa, alayhi salam. They would need to adjust.
These are belief type things rather than day-to-day.
Yeah.
Practical.
But it's just because it's such an easy transition then for a Jew that they were concerned, like they would have preferred if they became polytheists, because no Jew is going to become or can convert to that, but they would become Muslim. That is,
and you don't have to, you know, abstain from electricity on Saturday,
yeah,
for example. That's something you'd be given. But maybe we all need to switch off the electricity on at least one day a week. That seems a bad idea, actually. No, honestly, because there's too much screen time, too much this. I think maybe 2 days a week if they abstain. No problem. But the point is that there's going to be things which are going to be easier in some aspects. But maybe I think more things will be easier for you. I don't know. It depends on how strict you are as an Orthodox Jew. But now you've got much more, sorry to say about this, if you're getting married, you've got many races to choose from. No, it's just the truth.
Yes.
If you're a Sikh or a Jew, you have less races to choose from if you want to stay within your religion. As a Muslim, you have 60 Muslim majority countries, you have all these races, you can choose whatever you like. If you're into the black woman, if you're into this one, you're into that one. You're a black man, if you're a woman, you can choose. You can enjoy. You know what, it's true. And but you can go to this country, you can go to that country, Muslim majority. Oh, mosque there, fantastic. So there will be, I think, perks. You know, and we have to be honest about this. Let's be real.
Yeah, dunya perks as well as
dunya and akhira. Of course, the akhira. I mean, you won't be in hell. I mean, that's that's the main thing. You know, so there's lots of things. I mean, not all Jews we believe are going to hell anyway. I mean, of course, we don't know what exposure they've had to Islam and all that kind of thing. But you see, that's a really good point. What else, Sean? What do you want to say about this?
Well, I think another point that applies here.
Mm.
Well. It would also be the entitlement.
Yes.
That's another factor. If you feel like you should never compromise anything or everything has to go your way, the reality is nothing. Like, there would be no possible outcome in any situation but conflict and confrontation.
Mm.
And I think it's certain people, like, you know, the people say Karens. It's almost like they're sort of Karens of the, of like that sort of situation.
Yes. Yes.
Just to think about another way. Why were the Jewish tribes even there in the first place? They were waiting for their own prophet to come. So you can say it's almost hatred that didn't come from them, it came from the Arabs, and they were expecting the whole time. So imagine that whole adrenal pump, like, our prophet's coming, when he comes we're going to get all of you. Then from the prophet comes from the people you were looking down upon.
Yes.
So expectations were fully removed. Then that maybe built the hatred. It's that you built up such a high expectations and then it came from the people you hated the most.
And that was the ultimate test, wasn't it? Because at the end of the day, true humility is to accept the truth wherever it comes from. I mean, Al-Ghazali, he mentions humility. He says the worst kind of kibr is what the Prophet ﷺ mentioned. He says, "Batr al-haq wa hamt al-nas." Batr al-haq, which is to not acknowledge the truth, reject the truth, and hamt al-nas is to belittle the people. Okay, so you have two aspects of what it is, because we spoke about narcissism. By the way, this I read multiple books, and the way they describe narcissism is a range. And you've got to be careful of this usage, because especially leftists, they use this term in order to attack certain groups in a certain manner. Be careful of it. Leftists have used some psychological terms in a way which is it seems academic, which is not. Like, it's not in the literature, so beware of it. Like, for example, if a woman's going over a divorce or something like that, she'll say, "My husband was a narcissist," because it's so easy. I mean, I've even seen some definitions of narcissism as a disagreeable extrovert. If that is a minimum requirement of what it means to be a narcissist, then we're all finished. I mean, I'm finished doubly, trebly, you know. But I'm saying that really the Islamic notion is not this. The Islamic notion is, number one, this idea of arrogance, which is that you reject the truth and you belittle the people. These are the two main pillars. How most psychologists refer to entitlement, which is a people believing that they have special, they believe they require special treatment without cause or reason. That's the main definition. That one is not against us. We're for that definition, because they usually say narcissism requires four pillars or three pillars. Grandiosity, yes, which unfortunately, what if I say this? Grandiosity, entitlement, and lack of empathy. For example, there's a book I read called Should I Stay or Should I Go? It's like a relationship book by Ramasi. And another book, Do You Know Who I Am? I don't know why I was reading this book. And another book I read is called The Narcissist Test by Dr. Malkin. Yeah, I read these books on narcissism, and it seems to me they're all in agreement on these three points. Entitlement, grandiosity, and lack of empathy. Now, if you think about it, we agreed, lack of empathy is problematic. But there's also a book by Paul Bloom, which I find very interesting. It's called Against Empathy. I agree with his conclusion that it's not always right to moralize on the basis of empathy. Because, for example, and he uses many examples, he said, for example, let's use Madeleine McCann. Madeleine McCann was a girl that got lost in New England, yeah? Kidnapped, lost, or when she went to Spain, or I don't know what country she went to, and she got lost. White girl.
Portugal,
yes. Now, if the whole country was very sad about this situation, yeah? Now, I'm giving my own example, but this is the thing that Paul Bloom mentions, which is that when you empathize and you moralize on the basis of your empathy, then you can over-exaggerate based on emotional response. So, for example, Madeleine McCann was a big issue, but black girls and Asian girls and many girls are kidnapped on a daily basis all around the world. Why do we have a disproportionate pain when it comes to Madeleine McCann? Because it's all over the news media, which is controlled by the elites. So they've manipulated us to be empathetic towards this one girl. Empathy, therefore, is not a good way to always moralize. And Paul Bloom has this book called Against Empathy, which I think he makes the point that sometimes emotionalizing on this basis is not. So why I mentioned this to you is because narcissism has three pillars, according to these guys. Lack of empathy, selfishness, lack of empathy, grandiosity, and entitlement. Entitlement seems to me, okay, it's reasonable. But lack of empathy, we can discuss. And grandiosity, what do you mean by that? Because what is seen to be grandiose by one person might not seem to be grandiose by another. And like, for example, I was reading some of these books, and some of them say that a man thinking he deserves special treatment because he is a man is narcissism, because there should be equality. See, that's why they bring leftist agendas into psychological expressions. And you can see that although they're talking in a psychological way, they have a feminist idea and they're trying to impose it. And in fact, Ramasi herself, she mentions in the book, Should I Stay or Should I Go? She says many people in the Middle East, and I'm paraphrasing, and the East are conditioned towards narcissism because they believe that they are owed rights that other people shouldn't be owed due to their gender. Well, that condemns entire traditionalist discourse to narcissism. So what I'm trying to say is that you have to be careful of the usage of the word narcissism, because sometimes the ones who are using it, they synthesize their own ideological ideas with it. We have to remember the word narcissism is an English word. It has been Arabized, for example. They use it narsiji. They use this term. But it has connotations which we as Muslims have to be careful of. Our word, which is not colonialized word, is kibr that we use. And our ta'rif of kibr is batr al-haq wa ghamt al-nas. That's the Prophet ﷺ, he mentioned what that is. And the reason why I brought this to your attention is because I used the word narcissism a few times in this session. Narcissism of small difference, etc., etc. Narcissistic. So I'm saying that take what I say when I use the word narcissism with a pinch of salt, because this word has been exploited by the leftists to fulfill their own egalitarian agendas. It has. There's a lot of terms that have been exploited by the leftists to fulfill their own agendas, and it comes in the facade of psychology, pop psychology, and it even seeps into the Muslim community. You see? Anyway, the point I was making before was, so it's kibr. When you know, Al-Ghazali mentions in his book, he has a book where he's talking about kibr and arrogance and so on. He mentions that what the worst kind of arrogance, he has a book on arrogance, he has in Nahya al-Muddin, he says the worst kind of arrogance, the worst of all of it, is when you reject the truth, when you know it's true. When you reject the truth, when you know it's true. If the truth comes from a source that you don't accept, or that you don't like, or is strange to you, but you reject it because of the source rather than because of its content, then this is like an expression of arrogance. If, for example, I'm speaking to someone and says 2 plus 2 equals 5, as I actually did. No, honestly, I'm sorry to say, you're arrogant. And subhanAllah, the wahi has come, the revelation has come, to tamyiz and distinguishment, discernment, between those people who are sincere and those people who are arrogant. So when the truth comes and you reject it because of its where it's come from, that arrogance that you had, which is a Luciferian arrogance, the same arrogance that Shaitan had, Lucifer himself, which is also mentioned in the Old Testament. أَنَا خَيْرٌ مِّنْ I'm better than him. خَلَقَتَنِي مِّنْ نَارٍ وَخَلَقَتَهُ مِّنْ طِينٍ You created me from nar, fire, and you created him from clay. And it's even a false argument, because why is fire even better than clay? It's not. One is destructive, one is constructive. His one's worse. He's got a false argument, but he's arguing against God. He decides to argue against God. You can't tell me you're going to win an argument against God. You know he's the all-knowing, but... What do you mean? So it shows you're a bad person. And because it shows you're a bad person, where do you deserve to go? Hell. So the wahi is a test to see who goes to hell, and who is a good person, who is the musaddiq, and who is the mukathib, and who is the arrogant one. The wahi is a furqan. Anyway, so, yes, Fadal.
In the Bible, when it mentions Lucifer, they usually portray him as a preferred angel, or he was, you know, he had preferential treatment. Is that consistent? Like, is that similar in Islam? What do you say?
No, I mean, the majority opinion is وَإِذْ قُلْنَا الْمَلَائِكَةِ يَسْجُدُوا لِآدَمَ فَسَجِدُوا إِلَّا إِبْلِيسَ كَانَ مِنَ الْجِنِّ فَفَسَقَ عَنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّهِ That he was jinn. You know, so we have a different idea.
Okay.
But some scholars do say that.
The reason I would say that's sort of consistent is because maybe his test would be, okay, I created you from fire, you felt special. Now I'm going to give you a command to do this. And then I'm going to test you. Are you going to listen to me or are you going to stick to, you know, because I was created from fire, therefore I must be better. So if you take, like, so the Jewish people who've had, like, for over a millennia, you know, the prophets came from them. They sort of had this, you know, and they were monotheists.
Yes, it's an excellent paradigm.
It's a similar power. And of course, some of them accepted the religion of Islam.
Yeah, and another thing that's very interesting is because when Iblis said, I am better than him, the moment he said that, he showed that he's not better than him. Do you get it? And that's the same with the Yahud. The moment you say you're better than them, you're not following the command of Allah, you just showed you are not better than them. Instantaneously, because if he was better than them, you will take the.
Of course, you mean some of the supremacy.
Yeah, exactly. Ones.
I mean, not
exactly.
All of them, of course. Yeah,
you just showed that you're not better than them.
Yeah, yeah, it's true though.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It's an excellent point. Guys, should we pray Maghrib and come back? Yeah. Okay, we're going to pray Maghrib and come back and finish the session, inshallah. All right. So let's have a little bit more contributions on the questions that we asked before we continue. Did you want to say something yourself?
Yes, brother.
Yeah.
So, I was thinking about the fact that after the advent of Islam in some way became an intellectual threat, because if you look at Jews, they don't have this tendency of or urge to expand or give dawah, right? And there is a quote, actually, funny enough, I was reading this book, Abraham Fulfilled.
Oh, fantastic book.
And in the first chapter, it actually deals with some of the points you've mentioned today. It focuses on this Ishmael-Ishaq controversy, yeah? And there was a citation of a professor of religious studies. Can I cite it?
Yeah, is that okay?
Professor of religious studies, Rabbi Nancy Fuchs Kreimer. Sounds German. So she says here, through the ages, Jewish interpretations of Ishmael have largely depended on the social context of the authors. In early centuries, rabbis portrayed Ishmael in a variety of ways, negative, positive, and neutral. Mm. After the rise of Islam, the author's anxieties and fears were reflected in their consistently negative portrayal of Ishmael.
Mm.
So it shows that, you know, before the advent of Islam, they were nuanced about this topic.
Mm.
But after that, they became, you know, very negative about it. And I also think Dawah plays an aspect, as I mentioned at the beginning, because we have this, you know, expansion mentality, you know, giving Dawah, but they don't have that.
Mm.
So I think Islam is also in some way an intellectual threat.
Yes.
Yeah, that was so.
No, I think that was really excellent citation, yeah, and a really good point. I'm very glad you made it. And the fact that you've got a reference there from a Jewish rabbi only adds strength to the argument.
I mean, if we see, let's say, an ideological sort of shift where they became more negative to Ishmael because of Islam, one could assume they also had a political shift against the Muslims. And, you know, why would that be, you know, surprising?
Yeah, it's not surprising at all.
No.
I think it's very clear, actually. There was a clear motive, political and otherwise, to do what they did. And it's not all Jews, of course. It's those political elites and supremacists. I came across this hadith, which is very interesting, because maybe I should preamble this by saying part of the intellectual seerah is discussing how the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam deals with the natural range of emotions that human beings go through. So we've spoken about, if you think about it, throughout the 17 or so sessions that we've done, we've spoken about love, and we've defined it, and we've spoken about how the Prophet ﷺ was in love, and how he conceived of love, and how he reacted to love, and how we've spoken about grief, and the year of grief. We've spoken about fear, and fear management, and how do you, and one of the things we said was that one of the great things which shows the truthfulness of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ is that he was able to manage his fear at an astounding level as a political general, especially on the battlefield, in a way that was even beyond some of the guys who had more experience than him in the battlefield. And there's another excitement, another emotion, which we haven't spoken about, and it's excitement. And that's, well, I was reading this hadith and I wanted to discuss excitement, because excitement is one of the interesting emotions. Let me read the hadith and then we can speak about it. This hadith is actually in Al-Bukhari, right? While we were with Allah's Messenger in a holy battle, we never went up a hill or reached a peak or went down a valley, but raised our voices with takbir. Takbir is to say Allahu Akbar very loudly. Allah's Messenger came close to us and said, "O people, don't exert yourself, for you do not call a deaf or do not call upon a deaf or an absent one, but you call the all listener, the all seer." The Prophet said, "Abdullah ibn Qais, shall I teach you a sentence which is from the treasure of paradise? It is, La hawla la quwwata illa billah. There is no might or power except with Allah." Now, what I found quite interesting is that, imagine this, I mean, we have to kind of draw the picture a little bit. You had Hudaybiyah. Hudaybiyah was a great disappointment for the Muslim people, because they thought that they were going to do the pilgrimage and this was going to be a great symbol of success and so on. And then for a lot of Muslims, in fact, all of them, the companions, their hopes were dashed when they couldn't do the pilgrimage. So there was this feeling of sadness and this feeling of disappointment. Now imagine, it's like watching your team lose in a way, playing a sporting event or something like that. There's a certain feeling that you probably imagine. Now, the Quran is predicting, first of all, that there's going to be a great fatah, a great conquest, and you're going to get a lot of money out of this and so on. So all of these companions are getting overexcited. They're shouting takbir, Allahu Akbar. And how the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ is reacting to this is to tell them, calm down.
Managing their emotions.
Yeah, so this is very interesting, because it shows you that the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ not only managed his own fear and other people's fear in a very phenomenal way, but he was also able to do that with excitement itself. Which shows you the stoic nature, the temperate nature of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ. Now, in the West, you have whole books written about stoicism. In fact, there's one by Pigliucci called How to Be a Stoic. This guy, Ryan Holiday, writes multiple books on the topic. One of them I read recently, actually, called The Obstacle is the Way. Oh, it's not. I mean, I wouldn't give it a 5-star rating if you're honest with me. Sorry to say, although he is a popularizer of Stoicism, and people in the West now are thirsty for Stoicism because of the overstimulated environment, because there's so many things that they, because of mental health crisis and so on and so forth. The best book I've read on Stoicism, by the way, and I think one of the best books that a white man has ever written, that's a big statement, but it's probably true, is Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. I'm not sure if you've ever read this. Now, of course, when he's writing this book, it's a primary source, and he's writing a book, by the way, and invoking polytheistic gods. So obviously we have to discount that part or reject that part. But this book is extremely powerful book. It's not that long. I would highly recommend, you know, reading this book. I personally believe if this book was in the Islamic spiritual tradition, it would be one of the top books in the Islamic spiritual tradition. Marcus Aurelius's The Meditations. Another one, which is very interesting, is a book written called The Consolation of Philosophy. This, I prefer personally the primary source books, the old school ones, than the secondary source ones written by modern day authors, because I think the primary source ones, the people are going through something. For example, this book, The Consolation of Philosophy, the guy had like a week to live and he was writing a book before he was going to be executed. And he wrote, it's probably one of the best books written, because he's putting everything in perspective. If you've got a week to live, he's bringing the most wisdoms out of it and so on. Now, there are two books called The Consolation of Philosophy. There's one by Alan D. Bottom, contemporary guy that's, you probably know him from the School of Life YouTube channel. He's the voice that speaks over it. He's written that book. I'm not talking about that, by the way. I'm talking about the original. But I'm just saying, the reason why Stoicism has become very popular in the West today is because, as Schopenhauer mentions, who was a pessimist philosopher, he said that humanity oscillates between extreme boredom and extreme fear. Like, we as humankind, we oscillate between extreme boredom and extreme fear. When there isn't war and so on, we become very bored. And boredom is the opposite of what? Excitement. And what is excitement? Excitement really is stimulation. And you can have different kinds of excitement. For example, sexual excitement. We can talk about that. I've got many things to say about that, and many books I've read on that as well, but I'm not going to cite any right now. But that's one form of excitement. And excitement, by the way, has its limits. For example, if you've ever seen mentally ill people, someone with OCD, someone with schizophrenia, someone with bipolar disorder, someone with PTSD, you can have manic episodes, you can have overexcitement, overstimulation, autism, by the way. Someone who's autistic, they have a lower threshold for excitability. They have a lower threshold. This is very interesting, very to know. But the point is that because we are living in a world where we always require stimulation and excitement and so on, to know how to moderate your excitement is an extremely important part of the human experience. And what the Prophet is teaching us here is don't get too excited. Don't get too excited, even if you're approaching something which is going to be a great thing for you. Manage your excitement just as you manage your fear. There's two things: if the human being is able to manage, he becomes successful. His fear and his desires. If you're able to manage your fear and your desires, you become successful. If you're not, you don't. In fact, in psychology, they refer to someone who's disciplined in this way as straight conscientious. Someone who's able to discipline themselves. Routinize and whatever, despite the emotions, you still have a routine that you're doing, for example, or discipline that you're doing. So the Prophet ﷺ, you can see the sheer stoicism in the Prophet's character by calming down the companions. This is incredible leadership. This itself is an argument for the truthfulness of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ. On the issue of excitement, it's very interesting as well in the learning context. Yeah, I've got a definition here. What is excitement? Excitement is, according to the American Psychological Association, an emotional state marked by enthusiasm, eagerness, or anticipation, and general arousal. Obviously, you can get, we mentioned, a sensory overload, this idea. And an issue with excitement, especially if you're in a warrior context, if you're going to fight somebody, being overly excited is not good, because you can get something called adrenaline dump. And you can see this in a lot of the fights. If you watch UFC or boxing, as the person's so excited in the first round, the second or third round, they finish because they have an adrenaline dump. So you have to manage those emotions. You can also have burnout. And in fact, there are many, this is called Dodson's Law. When you're learning, as you can see here, like if you're in a state of learning, any learning you do, it has to, stress and stimulation has to be there, but to a certain level. If it's too much, then you become overly stressed. But if it's too little, you become overly bored. So Dodson's curve is that when you're in a state of productivity, some people call it the flow chart, that's very similar to this chart, is when you're being stimulated to a certain level, but you're not bored by the activity. And by the way, sometimes you can be bored. It's not a problem to be bored. Boredom is good sometimes. It's no problem. Just embrace the boredom. But the Prophet ﷺ basically is teaching us not to get overexcited. Now, first of all, there is a hadith of Umar and Asma bint Umais. But before I tell you about this hadith, because it's very interesting, it talks about gender relations. We were talking about gender relations and so on before the session. And how the companions used to discuss with each other. Because a lot of the crypto Salafists and others, they will make it as if there was no gender relations between men and women, that there was like this gender separation. This hadith, alongside so many others, I mean, I can cite so many, but this is an interesting hadith in this context of Khaybar, is one where Umar ibn Khattab is having a discussion, open, and they're both getting emotional with Asma bint Umais, where he was saying, we have more right to the Prophet ﷺ than you, because we were there and this and that. And she said no. She was arguing with Umar, and so much so to the extent where she went to the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and then she asked the Prophet, is he right? And he said, no, she's wrong actually. Which also dismisses this idea that Umar was heavy handed and he was, you know, throwing his weight around. And we said this before, one of the shubuhat of the disbelievers and the opponents of Islam is that Umar kept interjecting and changing the religion of Islam. When Umar had the idea that women should be covered, somehow an ayah came to confirm Umar's opinion, for example. When Umar, for example, decided that the prisoners of war should be punished and Abu Bakr didn't, and he was right, then this shows you that Umar's opinion, because he was a heavy-handed person and so on, and the Prophet and the community were so scared of him, they had to adjust things in his image. But here you have an example. Last week we were speaking about the example before, about when Abu Bakr was putting him in his place. But you can say that was Abu Bakr, a Siddiq. You know, he has a certain placement. Here you have a clear hadith of Asma bint Umais. He's not even married to her. You have a woman here, who she's arguing with Umar in public, going to the Prophet, and yani. The Prophet didn't say to him, Umar, what are you doing speaking to this woman? This is ikhtilat and free mixing. What's wrong with you? Taqillahi, astaghfirullah, is this diatha and dayuth? And how can you be? And he didn't say this to Umar al-Khattab. He said, I'm just saying, a lot of people would consider this to be free mixing. A man and a woman, like, let's be honest, if you saw a man, Muslim man and a Muslim woman speaking in a public place who's not married to each other, some people will go too far and say, what are you doing speaking anyway to him or her? And they're having a conversation. And there's even more hadith, by the way, with Asma bint Umais, who happened to be married to three of the companions. Well, I think four of them. Asma bint Umais, she was married to Ali ibn Abi Talib, Abu Bakr al-Siddiq, Ja'far, and who, I don't know who the fourth one was, maybe Umar himself, I can't remember. And she was married to another companion. And she was asked in public, who was your favorite husband? And she said, among the elders, it was Abu Bakr. And among the youngers, it was Ja'far. And then Ali said, what about me? So I said, what, are you having a joke, having a laugh with the ladies? This is Abu Bakr and Umar. Ali. Having a joke, and Asma is there talking about her experiences with her husband. He said, no, this is, how can you speak about your marriage like that? How could it be that these friends had the same wife anyway? What's going on here? Sorry to say, your idea, your cultural ideas, are not related to the religion of Islam. It might be a great shock for you to know this. But your crypto ideas of what constitutes proper gender relations is incommensurate, incongruent with the reality of the seerah. And if you applied your gender notions on the companions of the Prophet Muhammad, they would fail your test. Many of you, the extremist ones, I'm not saying, of course, the moderates and the mutaqafoon and the right ones and the correct Salafis. These are the ones we like, and we are them. No problem. But the crypto ones, no. Don't come with this, because we come with this. Now, on the other hand, you have the feminists and other imams who say a famous story about Umar ibn Khattab, and I want to dismiss the story. They say, Umar ibn Khattab, one time, a man, I'm sure you've heard this hadith, yes? A man, he has some issues with his wife. And then he went to who? He went to Umar ibn Khattab. So he can ask him how to solve his issues with his wife, because his wife kept answering back. He stood there to see, and he saw Umar ibn Khattab, huh? His wife was shouting at him, and he was just saying, yani something like, you know, yes, yes. And then he went and asked Umar, why is it that you accepted this from this woman? And according to this hadith, Umar, he turned around and he said, well, she bore my children, she does everything in the house, I have to accept a few humiliations here and there. Yani, not humiliations, I accept it, no problem. Something to this effect. I want to break the news. This hadith is weak, and it might even be fabricated, and it's an insult to Umar. And not only is it an insult to Umar, it goes against hadiths which are in Bukhari, which are clearly showing the opposite of this gender relation. What hadith are you talking about? The hadith, the famous one of Ibn Abbas, where it starts with, "Kunna nahnu ma'shara Quraysh yaghlibuna nisa'ana." أو نغلب نساءنا فلما قدمنا المدينة وجدنا قوم يغلبهم نساءهم أو كما قال. Which is that we of the people of Quraysh were people that we used to dominate. Umar is saying this, Umar ibn al-Khattab. We used to dominate our wives. Umar is the one that you were saying who was standing there and his wife was shouting him in public and the people couldn't hear. Because you have to find the weak hadith to explain your humiliation. He said no. He said, we were a people that we used to dominate our wives. When we went to Medina, we saw, and this might be controversial, say, we saw that the women there, they used to dominate their husbands. So the feminist now is getting excited again. So-called Muslim feminist, failure Muslim feminist, abject failure. Abject failure. She's getting excited and saying, okay, well, I want to be like those women who are dominating their husband. Put an asterisk next to dominating of the husband and let's continue the hadith. And Ibn Abbas said, well, actually, the wives of the Prophet were like this as well. And obviously, one of the wives of the Prophet is who? Hafsa, his own daughter, Umar's daughter. He went now, Umar al-Khattab, to the house to ask his wife if it's true. The moment he asked her, she had some response. And it was rude. First question, and this is Bukhari. Umar ibn Khattab, the one that you made into some kind of, sorry to say, humiliated individual and his wife. He said, "Aturaji'inani? Are you responding back to me?" This is the real Umar. This is the real Umar with his wife. This is the real, it's not this one. This is, and what happened? Huh? He then, فَجَمَعَ ثِيَابَهُ فَذَهَبَ, and so on. He went to see his daughter and he started getting angry with his daughter because of her behavior. But what I'm saying is that the shahid here is, imagine his wife, and that's why I said, put on the line, يَغْلِبُهُمْ نِسَاءَهُمْ, because we're going to go back. He considered a woman answering back to her husband as too much. So So imagine now why he conceives that those men of the Ansar are being dominated by his wife. Because his threshold for respect is too high. His threshold for respect is high. This is true, isn't it, what you're talking about, akhi? He's not, no, he's not going to accept what you and me accept. He's not going to accept this. If he was transported and he saw the state of what was going on in the Ummah, in the Muslim majority countries, in Egypt, I can only speak about my own country, so no one can say I'm being a racist. And the loud woman in the balcony. Have you seen this? The loud woman in the back, he said, shut your mouth. And shouting at her husband and pulling him like this in the marketplaces. You think this is Islam? You think Umar would have accepted this? You think any Sahabi, any man, even the Jews of Khaybar would not accept that one? No one would accept it. So don't make Umar into some kind of weak man so that you can justify on insolence and lack of control on your wife. But the reason why I mentioned this is because there's extremes. There's the feminist extreme and the crypto-Salafist extreme and the other extreme. It's not just Salafists, some other groups. Some Sufis are like this. Some Shiites are like this. They're too staunch when it comes to gender relations. And he said to me, one of them, from one place in the world, he said, I'm so proud. I said, why? He said, because I've never seen a woman in public in my life. And I said to him, but in your province, is there an issue when it comes to homosexuality? And he said, yes. I said, maybe this is the reason. It just so happens that homosexuality is exacerbated where you remove women from the equation altogether. Isn't that an interesting trend? So don't go too far, akhi, when it comes to gender relations. Don't go. Why do you think homosexuality is exacerbated in prisons? Do you think these men were like that? Many straight men, they end up liking the guy. They end up being gay, akhi. No, it's true. But because of the environment, if you have too much of a male environment and you remove the woman completely, you can't speak to a woman, you don't even know what a woman looks like, then you are putting a person in a position where maybe they will become more homosexually inclined. So what I'm trying to say to you is there are extremes in the ummah. And خير الأمور أوسطها. And it's a weak hadith, but still the meaning is true, which is that the best of actions are the most middle ones. Don't be too like this or like that. Be a little bit, you know, you have to realize, you know, when it comes to gender relations and mixing with the genders, that it's not going to be segregation. Anyway, we've mentioned already that there were multiple small battles. And let's look at this one. Mahmud ibn Maslam al-Ansari, he died in this battle, Muslim. And you know how he died? One of those probably Jewish supremacists, instead of face-to-face confrontation, he grabbed a big rock from the top of his fortress and he threw it on him. And this is exactly the IDF method. He doesn't want to engage in physical face-to-face confrontation unless he has major military advantage, 100, 200, 300,000 people, and big tanks and this one and that one, and still you're getting humiliated by this one now. So you have to go on top of a building and throw a rock. So there's no risk upon you, and there's only risk upon the enemy. It seems to me this whole idea of fortifying and stuff like that, it's not a new thing, by the way. And that's why Quran says, لَا يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ جَمِيعًا إِلَّا فِي قُرًى مُحَصَّنَةٍ أَوْ مِنْ وَرَاءِ جُدُرٍ بَأْسُهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ شَدِيدٍ تَحْسَبُهُمْ جَمِيعًا وَقُلُوبُهُمْ شَتَّى ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّهُمْ قَوْمٌ لَا يَفْقَهُونَ وَيَعْقِلُونَ. I forget the end of the ayah. But the point is that you don't know. They won't fight you altogether. These particular Jews, not all of the Jews, they won't fight you altogether. Unless, mentioned, they're in a fortified place. Behind a tank, in an airplane, has to be 10 to 1 advantage, 5 to 1 advantage, massive technical advantage. إلا في قرآن محصنة أو من وراء جزر, or behind the walls. And because they don't want to get hurt. Throw the rock, you know, this and that. بَأْسُهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ تَحْسَبُهُمْ جَمِيعًا. You think they're all together. They're not all together. And this Khaybar showed you that they're not all together. All of them were focused on their own little fortress. Our problem is we think Israeli society is unified. If you look at the Knesset, you'll realize that Israeli society is not unified. There are so many different opinions. Jews are not one monolithic thing, that they're all like unified in one thing. We've seen that there are many pro-Palestinian Jews. We've seen that there are secular Jews. We have seen that there are religious Orthodox Jews. We have seen that there are Reformed Jews. We have seen politically that they're against each other. When we're stereotyping the Jews, a lot of the time when we're doing it, we make them into this impenetrable. We actually help the Zionists in making them into some superhuman that we can undefeated. Look at what they've done with the economy, and look, they own everything, and this and that and. No, it's not that deep, yachi. It's not that deep, yachi. The reason why Israel is in the state that it's in is only and because of the West. You eliminate the West, you eliminate Israel. Where were they before the West? Scattered around the world. Don't pretend that this they're the invincible enemy and they're the Frankenstein and the monster. Because the moment you start to think that this narrative of aura of invincibility, we make this narrative on ourselves. They had a losing record. The Jewish supremacists of the old had a losing record, 4-0. They didn't even engage. They had no chance against the Muslim army. So much so that the Muslim had to keep them in and protect them and respect them and give them their synagogue, and they had their golden age in Islam. They had a 4-0 losing record. No one victory, not one. But we propped them up in this Israel and this and that. The Jewish supremacists and the Israelis and the Zionists. As if they're the perfect and they cannot be beaten. And Ali ibn Abi Talib, famous battle. Do you want to tell us about that one?
I'm not sure. The Sheikh can read the poem.
It's a famous poem of Ana alladhi sammatni ummi Haydara. And then what does the second one go, Sheikh? The
Sheikh has to do it.
Karih al-manzara.
Yes, so which means that I am the one who my mother say named me the lion. And then the second one is what? So I'm a very fierce looking lion kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah, but it sounds so much better in Arabic, doesn't it? We destroyed it, didn't we?
You keep repeating the word lion.
Yes, yes.
In Arabic you have many words for lion. Yes. So in every time he uses a different variation.
Absolutely, but can you see... When it comes to, this is maybe the narcissist book will say, this is grandiosity on behalf of Ali ibn Abi Talib. He's talking about himself like the lion and this and that. What do you mean? When it comes down to it, no, and it's, we're going to fight now. Marhab came up. Marhab, this guy is walking around and saying, I'm going to fight. And who? And he even killed one of the Sahabis. I forget who he is. He killed one of the Sahabis. And because he had such a fantastic record. And not true to think all Jews are cowards, by the way. Not true. Some of the Jews are very brave. Marhab is a good example of it. It's not true to think all the Jews are cowards or something. No. Marhab is a great warrior. You have to give him. Everyone was giving him his props and his respect, and he even beat a Muslim. But he was no match for Ali ibn Abi Talib, who gave him the one blow and finished decisive, liquidated him. He was completely liquidated, akhi. Neutralized, terminated, liquidated, finished. Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is why you step to Ali ibn Abi Talib. I was surprised he even got to the ring. Nowadays, sorry to say, the Israeli, this guy, I was training for him, and then the IDF soldier, he ran away. I don't know what happened. And I'm not Ali ibn Abi Talib, I can tell you that for a fact. What's going on? Anyway, but this passive-aggressive attack, because now, subhanAllah, how did the battle end? They kept taking over the fortresses until... There's a difference of opinion among the scholars. Was it a surrender? Did they surrender? Or was it that they agree on a particular kind of set of terms? And it seems to me it was probably a surrender. They probably surrendered. They said, forget this. We don't want to fight these guys. Wallahu alam. It could be that they agreed to a particular terms. I don't know for a fact. But there's a discussion about was it surrender or not. It seemed like they surrendered after all of this. And so... Very dishonorably, as they are, these supremacists, they bought food and so on, and this woman, she put poison all over the food. And the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ ate some of the food. And he himself was poisoned. But he, subhanAllah, it's one of the miracles of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, the meat told him, don't eat me because I have poison inside of me. in whatever way that happened, I don't know what happened. But it was too late for Bishr, who was one of the companions who ate this. Bishr ibn al-Bara. And he died, actually. So what happened was, in the first instance of discussion, did the Prophet ﷺ, did he forgive this Jewish woman for trying to poison and kill him? Because he asked her, and she confessed. She said, yes, I tried to kill you, because you did this and you did that. Resentment and embitterment and hate. And this passive-aggressive attacks is a hallmark of the supremacist.
No, didn't she say, as far as I know, she didn't say because of that. She said, I wanted to see if you're a true prophet. If you was a true prophet, you would have known that the meat would have told you. Is that not what happened?
That happened as well. That both of that. She said, you killed my brother, you killed my father, you killed my whatever. That's why I'd done it. But then she also mentioned that if you were a true prophet, well, it shouldn't have affected you anyway.
Which it didn't.
I love Islam. So now, if you wanted to see if she was a true prophet or not, here he is still alive. So why didn't you accept him?
Yeah, wasn't he going to forgive her? Except that it was qisas because he killed the companion.
So that's what Ibn Qayyim mentions. I came across this statement of Ibn Qayyim. He said that, how do we harmonize between the fact that the Prophet ﷺ, it seems in some riwayas and narrations that he forgave her for trying to kill him, and in other narrations it seems like she was actually given the death penalty. So he tries to harmonize it by saying that in the beginning he forgave her, but when Bishr died, that because this was now a matter of qisas, she killed a man, now she has to be killed. So it's a life for a life. And then she was killed on the basis of when he died, because the poison didn't infect, kill him straight away. It took a couple of maybe a day or two to kill him fully. He was in a bad state, and then Bishr eventually died. So they weren't expelled. The Jews were not expelled, but rather they were demilitarized. All their weapons were taken. Khaybar became a demilitarized zone. The gold and silver was taken away from them, and in fact, the Prophet ﷺ gave them extremely favorable terms, that they can even continue making money on their produce, so long as that the money is split 50-50 between the Muslim armies and themselves. And that's a very favorable thing for people that were so hostile, and it shows you the magnanimous nature of the Prophet Muhammad. And it also shows you he had different ways of dealing with different Jewish tribes. This is clear evidence. It's not to do with their Jewishness. He didn't deal with Banu Qurayza in the same way as he dealt with the people of Khaybar. The same way it's built with, it's the punishment is commensurate with the crime.
So there was no killing of babies or donkeys or cows, right?
No, that's only to be reserved for the Book of Numbers and 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3.
Good.
Now, the last thing I want to mention is about Safiya bint Huyay. Because, I mean, for example, remember when you had the discussion with Tommy Robinson, he kept mentioning Safiya bint Huyay. So it seems to me that the right wing and all these individuals, they bring up the issue of Safiya. And what Tommy Robinson, if you remember, I remember this discussion, this was probably one of the areas where Tommy Robinson was making the biggest lies and fumbles, and he needs to, and this is a great way to correct him. Where Tommy Robinson, thinking that he knows what he's talking about, and of course he doesn't know anything, stated that, you know, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, sorry to say, but he forced into sexual intercourse Safiya bint Huyay, because and this was his argument, and this is the argument of people like Robert Spencer and David Wood, which he took it from them, just to be clear, because there's a genesis of ideas. Tommy Robinson is not a free thinker. He doesn't know how to access sources. He doesn't have time to go into these things, so he'll rely upon people like David Wood, and you can see him liking their posts and stuff like that. The argument was that he forced himself upon her because she didn't have any menstruation or whatever it may be, and he just took her as a slave and he forced her. And there was, because how could it be, he would incredulously ask, how could it be that a woman who has just been in a war and her father has been killed would now marry the leader of the opposing war? This is so the only legitimate way that we can think of this is that if he had forced himself upon her. This is the argument. So there's ways to answer this. And the ways to answer this is, number one, it's very clear That and the hadith, if you want to take the hadith, because if you're using the hadith to justify the position, then you have to use all the hadith. Stated in the hadith, your father remained the staunchest Jewish enemy to me until Allah the Almighty killed him. O Safiya, if you choose Islam, I will keep you as my wife. If you choose Judaism, I may release you and you join your people. So clearly, if he's forcing himself upon her, why is he giving her a choice? It's hadith. Saying you can choose this or you can choose this. And he's not saying if you choose Judaism, you'll remain as a slave here and a prisoner of war. In fact, he's going further than that. And remember, her people are free. Her people are not in, expelled or something. They're in Khaybar. He says, you can go back, khalas. If you don't want to be with me, you can. You don't have to be. And then she stated in the hadith, very clearly, O Messenger of Allah, the Almighty says, وَلَا تَزِرُ وَزِرَةٌ وِزْرَ أُخْرَى, that no one shall bear the soul of what another person does. I appreciate Islam and I have believed in you even before I ended up in your custody. Moreover, I am in no need of Judaism, nor do I have a father or brother under it. Since you have given me an option to choose between Islam and this belief, I do prefer Allah and the Messenger. Now someone will say, maybe this hadith is weak, maybe it's this, maybe that, maybe the other. No problem. Even if someone does say that, we have the ayah from the Quran, which is the ayah in Kuntunna. تُرِدْنَا الْحَيَاةَ الدُّنْيَا وَزِينَتَهَا فَتَعَالَيْ وَمَتَّعْكُنَّا وَسَرِّحْكُنَّا سَرَاحًا جَمِيلًا in Surah Al-Ahzab, which is that if you, O wives of the Prophet, if you want to prefer the life of the adornments of this life, I will let you go. And all scholars of Islam say this was efficacious on all the wives, including Safiyyah bint Uqayy. Meaning a choice was explicitly given. If you want to accept it from the hadith, then it's in the hadith. If you don't want to accept it from the hadith, then the choice was explicitly given to all wives as per the ayah in the Quran. If someone says, I don't accept the Quran or the hadith, we'll say, well then, you don't even have a right to believe that a man called Muhammad married a woman called Safiya, let alone to claim such and such about it, because you're getting this from the hadith. There's only one source, which is the Islamic narrative. So this is a clear response to those who believe what the argument. And look, it shows you that the Prophet ﷺ not only had this relationship, he was very protective, and I've put a hadith there, where the Prophet ﷺ was very sick in his last days. Safiya said, you know, if it was up to me, I would take this sickness from you. And some of the wives were rolling their eyes and acting in a very bad manner or saying some things under their breath. And the Prophet ﷺ protected her against the wives. And we know that the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ protected Safiya against the wives when they were attacking her because she was Jewish. And he said, well, you come from a holy lineage. And this by far is one of the best arguments against those who say Islam is an inherently anti-Semitic religion, whereby they define anti-Semitism as attacking Jews because they are Jews. Because Islam, if it was an anti-Semitic religion, why is the Prophet Muhammad, number one, marrying an ethnic Jew? He married an ethnic Jew. Number two, responding to the other wives and giving her, you know, words to say and arguments to make against the other wives on the basis of her noble lineage, which happens to be a Jewish lineage. This is decisive evidence. And with that, we will conclude. I hope you have found this as interesting as I have. It's been a fantastic session, and inshallah, we will conclude this whole series very soon. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.